Good afternoon. It's indeed a minute past 3 p.m. on this Monday, July 27, 2015. And you are now listening to the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial and streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. Click on the listen link so that you may receive and pick up our free live streaming link. Let's open with a little bit of Arab American music here. Why not?
I'm من سواك بالهوى ما لي سبيل مر على عين يرضي الطياب سبيل وعلى ربعك أنا جعل سبيلي لأجلك هجرت أهلي والصحاب يا
most likely my favorite single cut track on that album, the Rounder Records, 1997 print on a CD of the music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. Arabic folk songs is the general title they give it, but as you may have noticed, and if you've heard this program in the past, you'll know, considering how often I like to play this, you heard the voice of Danny Thomas, yes, that Danny Thomas, actor and comedian, says here, although Danny Thomas performed widely for the Arab American community, this record, made in 1952, is his only recording of Arab music. I happen to know of another one, but I don't know if it's available. The proceeds from the record, as well as from the numerous haflas, or parties, presented by Thomas, benefited St. Jude Hospital Foundation, which has become one of the most important institutions in the world for the research and treatment of children's diseases. Known by, quote, mainstream America only as a comedian and actor, Thomas continued to sing Arabic songs in cameo and guest performances until just a few months before his death in 1991. Here, Thomas was singing a medley of Lebanese folk songs, beginning with the ever-popular Lebanese genres Mijana and Ataba, supported by the instrument the oud, etc., etc. Thanks to St. Jude's Hospital Foundation for the premier edition that recording. It's the only recording of Arabic music, but he did a lot of singing. Good old Danny Thomas. Marlo's dad. Yeah, hi. My name is Lawrence Ren Tawil. I'm your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian America in Santa Cruz County, and I have my own two radio programs on Free Radio Santa Cruz. They are both entitled Mideast Migraines, the Mideast Migraines radio program. And identify myself as Palestinian, Palestinian American, obviously says something about the political slant of almost everything I talk about here. I do want to give a shout out to the many people that I happen to pass along my business card last night. I was at a fascinating event featuring two speakers having to do with the 9/11 terror attacks. Depending on how you define terror, you may or may not want to call them terror attacks, but they were terror among the populace of the affected nation, in this case America, was definitely the intention, regardless of who perpetrated 9/11. Both the speakers were very strong on the fact that we're dealing with false flag operations here. In the case of America's 9/11 on September 1st, 2001. September 1st? I'm sorry. Did I say that? September 11th, 2001. The woman, Barbara, I forget her last name, gave extensive information about what really happened at the Pentagon, what really did hit the Pentagon, what didn't, and why knowing the difference matters. And the other speaker who opened the presentation, the dual presentation, his name was Dr. Kevin Barrett of Madison, Wisconsin, I believe, spoke about the French 9/11. Yes, he maintains that the Charlie Hebdo assault, or some would say France's 9/11, on a much, much lower scale, of course, in terms of actual damage and number of deaths compared to America's 9/11, was indeed a false flag operation. Now, I'm not going to get into the substance of what those two speakers talked about, not at all. Just to let you know that I was at the event, and there were many fascinating, and concerned and enlightened individuals who attended, a small crowd, and that's because some of these events simply don't get the pre-coverage that they deserve. But it was good. Books and DVDs, of course, were on sale. And another wonderful conspiracy wacko evening, as some would dismiss it as, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. And again, I let the audience know in my brief PSA that I have the radio program, and I handed out my business card for the details of if they want to listen to the show. Well, if any of you happen to be listening to the show right now, I want to remind you that my reading of Christopher Bolin's book, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, is on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, every Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, Pacific Daylight Time. I'm only a few chapters away from the end of the book now, about three-quarters of the way through it. So any of you might happen to be tuned in right now or will be listening to a podcast of this program later, Monday's show is not when I read the Bolin book. Readings of Chris Bolin's book is on Saturday at 11 a.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's a live show, and of course I make it a point to at least try to record and file those programs so that you may listen to them at your own convenience at a later time, if need be, if you so desire. So Saturday is when I read Chris Bolin's book. However, I've got a bit of a surprise for you here now. happened to be watching a film entitled Noam Chomsky, Rebel Without a Pause. Rather dramatic title for a movie, but the movie is not all that long and really is concentrates 90% of it on Noam Chomsky speaking at various events. And there are six main parts to this. And let's see. Oh, now I can't find the... There it is. There are six sort of chapters to this film. And I'm just going to play for you the one dealing with 9/11. This film entitled Noam Chomsky, Rebel Without a Pause, has, as I said, six chapters. One is the War on Terror, two, Iraq, three, Mass Media and Control. I may play that for you two later. Four, The Subject of Fear, five, Activism, and this one, six, 9/11. Again, Noam Chomsky is professor... Grab the blurb here. MIT professor and respected political analyst Noam Chomsky speaks his mind on sober issues, including all the ones that I mentioned. And the film, by the way, the film as a whole also features interviews with his wife. Activists, fans, and critics examines the truths and myths surrounding the anti-capitalist and longtime advocate of liberty and justice. 2003 movie, actually. It's an hour and a quarter. Again, not the whole thing, but just the section on 9/11. I will play for you now. He is Jewish. His wife is Jewish, brought up in the Hebrew school. And he has, in many, many cases, been highly, highly critical of the Zionist state of Israel. Okay, let's listen to Noam Chomsky on the subject of the 9/11 terror attack. If I can just get this thing going here. Try it again.
You look through hundreds of years of history. The West has a virtual monopoly of violence. So massive terror is the kind of thing we do to them. You know, they're not supposed to do it to us. September 11th was the first break. It's the first time in hundreds of years that any Western country has suffered on home soil the kind of the thing they do routinely everywhere else. You know, and in Israel, it's sort of the same. Actually, it was pretty striking for me to see this. I mean, after September 11th, I had a ton of interviews everywhere, except the United States, of course. And often it was national radio and TV. And often a couple of times it turned out to be Irish and television and BBC back to back. And the difference in reaction was startling. You know, I mean, things that if I said this much on Irish TV, okay, discussion over, everyone understands what I'm talking about. Try to say it on BBC, you have to go on for like about an hour to explain to them what you mean. The Irish Sea is a chasm, you know, and it just depends who's been holding the whip for 800 years and who's been under it for 800 years. And the same is true everywhere else in the world, you know. But for the West, the idea that anybody should do to us a fraction of what we regularly do to them is just outrageous, you know. And the same is true in Israel. It's a 35-year occupation. I mean, up until very recently, they were immune, literally immune from retaliation from within the territories. And they weren't acting very nicely there. It was brutal, you know, humiliating, repressive, robbing the resources, kicking the people out, and so on. But there was no retaliation. Okay, last year or two, there's some retaliation. So it's, you know, scandalous. It's also considered a scandal in the West, right? Because we do it to them, it's okay, but they do it to us, it's not okay. You know, so if Israel invades Lebanon with U.S. backing and kills 20,000 people, well, you know, it's the way the cookie crumbles. It's not a problem. But if it goes the other direction, a couple of people get killed, yeah, that's a horror story. Well, the question that I was asked is, what was the effect of 9/11 on organizing? Seems to me it was kind of a dual effect. September 11th, it was immediately predicted, and now we can look back and see that the prediction was correct, that every repressive force in the world would take it as a window of opportunity to extend what they were doing. So, for example, the Russians took it as an opportunity to extend the attack in Chechnya, pretending that it's a war on terror, and now with the authorization of Washington. The Chinese did the same in western China. Indonesia did the same in Aceh, Israel and the occupied territories, and so on down the list. Furthermore, just about every government used it as an opportunity to try to impose greater discipline on their own populations, under, again, the pretext of a war on terror. So that's true of the more dictatorial states, like, say, Central Asia. It's also true of the more democratic societies with prevention of terrorism ordinances and other devices of one sort or another, mainly to try to discipline their own populations. These are just continuations of tendencies that are already in process, using this kind of opportunity to escalate it. And that was predictable, and of course it's happened. If you're interested in terror, you should look at its causes. Now, if for the point of view of apologists for state violence, like the ones you're mentioning, you're not allowed to look at the causes because that's considered rationalization or justification. So if you try to look for the causes, like every sane person does, that's rationalization. What you're supposed to do is have tantrums and scream about Islamic fascism and blame it on the bad genes of the Arabs or something. But you're not allowed to look at the causes, and there's a good reason for that. As soon as you look at the causes, you start looking in the mirror. And that you have to block. You know, the main task of intellectuals, always, but now too, is to make sure that people never look in the mirror. We never look at ourselves. We only look at other people.
The heckling, the leafleting at the door, there's, well, as you can imagine, there's an enormous amount of hostility. And the different groups will interrupt in the question-answer period and, you know, oh, yeah, there's a lot of, that shows up often.
In fact, one useful effect of the end of the Cold War is the clouds have lifted somewhat and reality is coming into clearer view, and it takes a little more effort to suppress what should have been obvious all along. Well, 5 years after this came the review of post-Cold War deterrence that I was quoting earlier, and now the meaning of deterrence is clarified. You have to deter those who seek an independent path. And it's only by suffering really deep historical amnesia of the kind that Orwell attributed to a properly functioning educational system, it's only by that you can fail to recognize the pedigree of this doctrine, which goes back to the end of World War II, and there are plenty of precedents earlier in the history of other imperial states. Perhaps the most instructive illustration of all of this is Cuba. It's an example which happens to be highly relevant and very timely.
Okay, obviously, Mr. Professor Chomsky's continuing on to other areas. Forgive me if this is beating a dead horse here, but I want to replay the beginning of 9/11, because I realized the volume level, from my end of it anyway, could have been a little higher. Let's just the first couple of minutes of the beginning of the preceding piece on 9/11.
You look through hundreds of years of history, the West has a virtual monopoly of violence. So massive terror is the kind of thing we do to them. You know, they're not supposed to do it to us. September 11th was the first break. It's the first time in hundreds of years that any Western country has suffered on home soil the kind of the thing they do routinely everywhere else. You know, And in Israel, it's sort of the same. Actually, it was pretty striking for me to see this. I mean, I had, after September 11th, I had a ton of interviews everywhere, except the United States, of course. And often it was national radio and TV. And often it turned, a couple of times it turned out to be Irish and television and BBC back to back. And the difference in reaction was startling, you know. I mean, and, you know, things like things that I said this much on Irish TV, okay, discussion over, everyone understands what I'm talking about. Try to say it on BBC, you have to go on for like about an hour to explain to them what you mean. The Irish Sea is a chasm, you know, and it just depends who's been holding a whip for 800 years and who's been under it for 800 years. And the same is true everywhere else in the world, you know. But for the West, the idea that anybody should do to us a fraction of what we regularly do to them is just outrageous, you know. And the same is true in Israel. It's a 35-year occupation. I mean, up until very recently, they were immune, literally immune from retaliation from within the territories. And they weren't acting very nicely there. It was brutal, you know, humiliating, repressive, robbing the resources, kicking the people out, and so on. But there was no retaliation. Okay, last year or two, there's some retaliation. So it's, you know, scandalous. It's also considered a scandal in the West, right? Because we do it to them, it's okay. But they do it to us, it's not okay. You know, so if Israel invades Lebanon with U.S. backing and kills 20,000 people, well, you know, it's the way the cookie crumbles. It's not a problem. But if it goes the other direction, a couple people get killed, yeah, that's a horror story.
All righty, let's... let's put that recording aside for now. I may or may not play another part of it towards the end of the program. This is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. And it's 3:28 Pacific time. We broadcast at 101.3 FM and stream live at freakradio.org. Freakradio.org. Speaking of technical faux pas, yeah, sorry for that very slight possible potential volume problem a couple of minutes ago, but I also want to perhaps apologize for the beginning of last Monday's program. 7 days ago, I seem to remember having a number of problems with the technical display here and tried to pass along actually an advertisement for the event I was talking about last night, the French 9/11 and what happened, really happened and didn't really happen at the Pentagon on 9/11. I tried to do the ad for it, but the ad wasn't popping up. And then it was either last week or the week before that I played an interview on Press TV. Yes, the oh-so-infamous Iranian-sponsored Press TV, which still has some fascinating material and interviews and viewpoints, regardless of what one may think of the fact that it's based in Tehran. But that one of the speakers on the program had a very, very thick Persian accent, and so I realized it might not have been the best way to begin a program. But if you want to listen to it again, it's eventually I'll get the podcast up there. If you're interested in podcasts or reruns, refeeds, whatever you want to call them, of my programs, Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz, go to the website radioforall.net. That's the word radio, the number 4, R-A-D-I-O, the digital character 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net, radioforall.net. Simply plug in Mideast Migraines or write it in the search box, and you'll get my shows. Also, last week, 90% of the show was spent on a single article by a Jewish man. It's one of my favorite all-time articles, certainly that I've ever read on this program. And I'm in the, in the third year of this radio program now, well into it. or beginning the, my fourth year doing this on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The article was entitled simply New Jerusalem, where the author really gets down and dirty about what it is, the way, shape, and form that the city and municipality and environs of Jerusalem really is from the standpoint of its boundaries, its rather obtuse way of growing in order to take in as many Jewish neighborhoods and prepare for new Jewish residents as possible. It's become a kind of municipal octopus, the way how the city boundaries of Jerusalem has grown. At any rate, you really want to get into this fascinating demographic picture of the new Jerusalem, Jerusalem as it is taking shape and form today. Jerusalem is, as the Prime Minister and so many other Israeli Zionists will tell you, the eternal and undivided capital of the Jewish people, even though going back some 50 to 80 years, there was a tiny Jewish minority living consistently within the city of Jerusalem. And in order to make it the eternal and indivisible capital of Judaism, they had to funnel in as many Jewish souls as they could in order to justify the use of that name, that title, that identifier. And, of course, the same general attitude applies to Eretz Israel, or what they call the Land of Israel, the eternal and indivisible home of the Jewish people, even though there are very marked and remarkable differences between the modern-day Jewish culture and ancient Hebrew people who first populated that land. So much for the developing cosmopolitan, rather universal nature of Palestine, even under the British and the Turks. That's changed quite a bit. So go to radioforall.net and look for New Jerusalem. I don't believe I've loaded that program up to radioforall.net yet, but it's in a matter of time. As I said, it takes up most of the 2-hour program. To get through it all, and it's a very lengthy article, but it's such a prize piece of literature as far as I'm concerned. It's very revealing. It is an expose of modern Jerusalem. Okay, now can we please get into today's show? It's already 3:34. Yeah. I want to talk about... see if this is the... no, that's not the one. Two societies. Two... situations that are remarkably the same here. I've talked quite a bit about Israeli repression of Palestinians under their military occupation. I have an item here called Selling Off Apache Holy Land. The opinion pages of what website this is from the New York Times Cyber Edition. The New York Times opinion section and a version of this particular op-ed appears in print on May 29 of this year, New York, page A23 of the New York edition, with the headline, Selling Off the Holy Land. Which Holy Land are we talking about here? Specifically, Selling Off Apache Holy Land, May 29. By Lydia Millett of Tucson, about an hour east of Phoenix, Arizona, U.S. of A., near a mining town called Superior, men, women, and children of the San Carlos Apache tribe have been camped out at a place called Flat Oak for more than 3 months, protesting the latest assault on their culture. 300 people, mostly Apache, marched 44 miles from tribal headquarters to begin this occupation on February 9. The campground lies at the core of an ancient Apache holy place where coming-of-age ceremonies, especially for girls, have been performed for many generations, along with traditional acorn gathering. It belongs to the public under the multiple-use mandate of the Forest Service and has had special protections since 1955, when President Dwight D. Eisenhower decreed the area closed to mining, which, like cattle grazing, is otherwise common in national forests because of its cultural and natural value. President Richard M. Nixon's Interior Department in 1971 renewed this ban. Despite these protections, in December 2014, last December, Congress promised to hand the title for Oak Flat over to a private Australian-British mining concern. A fine print rider trading away the Indian Holy Land was added at the last minute to the must-pass military spending bill, the National Defense Authorization Act. A fine print rider. We're hearing more and more about those these days, aren't we, folks? By doing this, Congress has added over a sacred Native American site to a foreign-owned company for what may be the first time in our nation's history. Handing over a sacred Native American site to a foreign company. First time in our nation's history. The Apache are occupying Oak Flat to protest this action. To them, a sacrilegious and craven sell-off of a place, quote, where Apaches go to pray, in the words of the San Carlos Apache Tribal Chairman Terry Rambler. The site will doubtless be destroyed for any purpose other than mining. Resolution Copper Mining will hollow out a vast chamber that, when it caves in... I got to stop doing that. Resolution Copper Mining will hollow out a vast chamber that, when it caves in, will leave a 2-mile-wide, 1,000-foot-deep pit. The company itself has likened the results of its planned mining at Oak Flat to that of a nearby meteor crater. The land grab was sneakily anti-democratic, even by congressional standards. For more than a decade, the parcel containing Oak Flat has been coveted by Rio Tinto, Resolution's parent company, which already mines its own private land in the surrounding area, for the high-value ores beneath it. The swap, which will trade 5,300 acres of private parcels owned by the company to the Forest Service and give 2,400 acres, including Oak Flat, to Resolution Mining so that it can mine the land without oversight, had been attempted multiple times by Arizona members of Congress on behalf of the company. Parenthetically, among those involved was Rick Renzi, a former Republican representative who was sent to federal prison in February for 3 years for corruption related to earlier versions of the land transfer deal. It always failed in Congress because of lack of support, but this time was different. This time, the giveaway language was slipped into the defense bill by Senators, you may have guessed it, John McCain and Jeff Flake of Arizona at the 11th hour. The tactic was successful only because, like most last-minute writers, it bypassed public scrutiny. It's worth noting that Rio Tinto affiliates have been McCain campaign contributors and that Mr. Flake, before he made it to Congress, was a paid lobbyist for Rio Tinto Rusing Uranium, a huge uranium mine in Namibia, Africa. Mr. McCain and others assert that the mining project will be a boost to the local economy. though it's unclear how many of the 1,400 promised jobs would be local. A Superior Area Miners group, in fact, opposes the swap on the basis that it won't help the local people or economy. Rio Tinto, incidentally, has been called out in the past for environmental devastation. "Why is this place sacred?" said Wenzler Nosey Sr., a former chairman of the San Carlos Apache, in a recent interview with Cronkite News. Quote from Nosey Sr., "No difference to Mount Sinai, how the Holy Spirit came to be," end quote. If you don't want to take his word for it, the archaeological record at Oak Flat contains abundant evidence that the Apache have been here, quote, "since well before recorded history," according to congressional testimony by the Society for American Archaeology. If Oak Flat were a Christian holy site, or for that matter, Jewish or Muslim, no senator who wished to remain in office would dare to sneak a backdoor deal for its destruction into a spending bill. No matter what mining company profits or jobs might result. But this is Indian religion. Clearly, the Arizona congressional delegation isn't afraid of a couple of million conquered natives. Clearly, the Arizona congressional delegation isn't afraid of a couple of million conquered natives. The truth is that for Mr. McCain, Mr. Flake, and others who would allow this precious public land to be destroyed, it's not only the Indians who are invisible. The rest of us are also ghosts, remnants of a quaint idea of democracy. Oak Flat may still be saved, albeit with difficulty, since the bill's language stipulates, quite simply, that 60 days after the federal, quote, environmental impact statement is complete, the land will belong to Resolution. In other words, that the swap will occur no matter what the environmental study says. But, like all laws and pieces of laws, it can be reversed by new legislative language. The deal is an impressive new low in congressional corruption, unworthy of our country's ideals no matter what side of the aisle you're on. It's exactly the kind of cynical maneuvering that has taught the electorate to disrespect politicians, a disdain for government that hurts everyone. If ever there was a time for Congress to prove its moral mettle to the public, this is that time. The rider should be repealed. Again, this was an opinion editorial in the New York Times, both print and cyber editions, by Lydia Millet, perhaps Lydia Millet, who is the author, most recently, of the novel Mermaids in Paradise, and a contributing opinion writer. And, okay, now we've talked about the kinds of post-conquest manipulation and exploitation that the lands of the exploited and conquered have to go through in our own United States. Now I want to talk about water in Israel-Palestine, one article right after the other here. A local friend notes that this was sent to me by a local activist friend in response to an article lauding Israel as a water superpower that will now help California. With her permission, I am sharing her response. And in order to, let me see. Here it is, folks. Just looking at it. Now, I don't think I have... Well, I wouldn't want to read the offending article or spend too much time on it anyway, but here is what Haaretz, Israel's premier newspaper, says about this topic. or as the title identifies it, the Israeli quote-unquote Watergate scandal, the facts about Palestinian water. Again, this is what Haaretz says Monday, July 27, today, on this side of the pond. Incidentally, this appears in Haaretz's section called The Worst Lies That Israel Told Itself This Week. By Amira Haas, The Israeli Watergate Scandal, The Facts About Palestinian Water. A photo here of two Palestinian boys at a clearly environmentally compromised small puddle of water at what appears to be a construction site. It looks like it's full of cement or has the base of cement in it, and they're cupping their hands to drink water from it. Gaza children, this isn't Gaza, drinking from a broken pipe. Who knows where the pipe emanates from. Okay, subtitle, by the way, Israel has adopted a drip-feed approach to providing the Palestinians with water instead of letting them control their own natural resources. February 16 by Amir Haas. Rino Tsror is an interviewer who argues with rather than flatters his subjects. Yet last Thursday, he didn't do his homework and let Justice Minister Tzipi Livni throw sand in the eyes of the public about everything regarding the flap over water with Martin Schulz, the president of the European Parliament. Livni, Justice Minister, was invited onto his army radio program as a sane voice who had criticized the behavior of Economy Minister Naftali Bennett and company toward Shulman, that Bennett's Habiat Hayahudi party, stormed out of the Knesset, Israel's parliament, during a speech by Schulz when he allowed himself to wonder whether indeed Israelis were allotted four times as much water as Palestinians. Quote, I told the European Union Parliament president, you were wrong. They intentionally misled you. She told Zror, Livy told Zror, and went on to say, that is not how the water is allocated. Israel gives the Palestinians more water than what we committed to in the interim agreements. End quote. The words of Justice Minister Tzipi Livni of Israel. The very word gives should have lit Zror's fuse, but Livni kept buttering him up. In her learned tone with her grumbles against the Palestinian position on desalinated water and the Joint Water Committee. So, here are the facts, according to Amira Haas here. Here are the facts. Bullet point. Israel doesn't give water to the Palestinians. Rather, it sells it to them at full price. Fact, the Palestinians would not have been forced to buy water from Israel if it were not occupying power, which controls their natural resource, and if it were not for the Oslo II Accords, which limit the volume of water they can produce, as well as the development and maintenance of their water infrastructure. Fact, this 1995 interim agreement was supposed to lead to a permanent arrangement after 5 years. The Palestinian negotiators deluded themselves that they would gain sovereignty and thus control over their water resources. The Palestinians were the weak, desperate, easily tempted side and sloppy when it came to details. Therefore, in that agreement, Israel imposed a scandalously uneven, humiliating, and infuriating division of the water resources of the West Bank. Fact, the division of water is based on the volume of water Palestinians produced and consumed on the eve of the deal. The Palestinians were allotted 118 million cubic centimeters, MCM, 118 million cubic, check that, 118 million cubic meters. A meter is like 39 inches. Don't confuse that with a centimeter. 118 million cubic meters per year. The Palestinians were allotted from three aquifers via drilling agricultural wells, springs, and precipitation. Pay attention, Reno's Roar. The same deal allotted Israel, 483 MCM versus 118 million for Palestinians. 483 MCM annually from the same resources to Israel, and it has also exceeded this limit in some years. In other words, some 20% goes to the Palestinians living in the West Bank, and about 80% goes to the Israelis on both sides of the Green Line, which is to say, in Israel proper, the state of Israel, which Palestine officially, legally accepts the existence of, and the other side of the Green Line, which means illegal by international law, Jewish-only settlements in occupied territory, who, by the way, also enjoy resources from the rest of the country. Why should Palestinians agree to pay for desalinated water from Israel, which constantly robs them of the water flowing under their feet? Fact: the agreement's second major scandal, Gaza's water economy / management, was condemned to be self-sufficient and made reliant on the aquifer within its borders. How can we illustrate the injustice? Let's see. The Negev residents were required to survive on aquifers in the Be'er Sheva Arad region without the national water carrier and without accounting for population growth. Overpumping in Gaza, which causes seawater and sewage to penetrate into the aquifer, has made 90% of the potable water undrinkable. Can you imagine if Israelis had peace and justice in mind, the Oslo Agreement would have developed a water infrastructure linking the strip to the rest of the country. Fact. According to the deal, Israel will keep selling 27.9 million cubic meters of water per year to the Palestinians. In its colonialist generosity, Israel agreed to recognize Palestinian future needs for an additional 80 MCM per year. It's all detailed in the agreement with the miserly punctiliousness of a capitalist tycoon. Israel will sell some, and the Palestinians will drill for the rest, but not in the Western Mountain Aquifer. That's forbidden. But today, the Palestinians produce just 87 MCM in the West Bank. That's 21 MCM less than Oslo allotted them. The drought, Israeli limits on development and drilling new wells, and limits on movement are the main reasons. Palestinian mismanagement is secondary. So, Israel, quote, gives, or rather sells, about 60 MCM per year. True, that is more than the Oslo II Accords agreed for it to sell. And the devastating conclusion? Palestinian dependence on the occupier has only increased. Keep in mind, folks, this is an article from Israel's very own Haaretz magazine. February 16 by Amira Haas. Finishing up here. Palestinian dependence on the occupier has only increased. Fact, Israel retained the right of the mighty to cap infrastructure development and rehabilitation initiatives. For example, Israel has imposed on the Palestinian Authority pipes that are narrower than desired, forbids connecting communities in Area C to the water infrastructure, tarries in approving drilling, and delays replacing disintegrating pipes, hence the 30% loss of water from Palestinian pipes. Fact, 113,000 Palestinians are not connected to the water network. 113,000 Palestinians not connected to water. Hundreds of thousands of others are cut off from regular supply during the summer months. In Area C, Israel forbids even the digging of cisterns for collecting rainwater. And that's called giving. Area C, by the way, is an Israeli administrative designation of land, certain area of land around Jerusalem, roughly between East Jerusalem and including much of the West Bank. And finally, bullet-pointed fact, instead of spending time calculating whether the average Israeli household's per capita consumption of water is four times or, quote, only three times that of Palestinian consumption, open your eyes. The settlements bathed in green, and across the road, Palestinian urban neighborhoods and villages are subject to a policy of water rotation. The thick pipes of Mikarot, Israel's national water provider, are heading to the Jordan Valley settlements, Jewish settlements, and a Palestinian tractor next to them transports a rusty tank of water from afar. In the summer, the faucets run dry in Hebron and never stop flowing in Kiryat Arba and Beit Hadassah to Jewish settlements. All of this is intentionally misleading. That's the final statement, question in this article. All of this is intentionally misleading. I think she was referring to the initially talked about interview. So there is a loose comparison between the downtrodden indigenous peoples of America, one part of the United States of America, the southwestern part of the country, and how they and their what are supposed to be their resources are being exploited by the masters, white masters in that case. A rough comparison between that scenario and the situation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, mentioned once, regarding their very precious natural resource, their own water, which Israel has a way of taking control of, or at least taking control of the headwaters and manipulating that situation, effectively depriving hundreds of thousands of Palestinians of water on a regular basis. Well, it is 2 minutes before 4 o'clock. This is the Mideast Migraines Free Radio Santa Cruz program, the Monday edition. Now a month or two beyond celebrating our third year on the air. Free Radio itself, Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org, is 20 years old. It turned 20 last March, 4 months ago. And we're still thinking about throwing a more official party / fundraiser, possibly. But, you know, even after the nice round number of 20 whole years, the economy and other immediate local circumstances have emburdened us with forcing us to deal with those situations, and it sure wouldn't hurt for people to who listen to this service and are aware of it to consider donating. We have our hand out, just like countless thousands of others have their hands out these days, and however, keeping in mind that Free Radio's very own bylaws actually forbid this radio service from taking contributions from corporations so that we may remain free of corporate editorial influence, also prevent us from receiving other certain massive dollops of dollars. We reply on yours truly and our other wonderful radio creator, program creators and programmers and hosts to support this service with our own monies. But nobody pays us. We pay Free Radio to keep this sucker going and humming along. I think I'm roughly current in my payment of dues. The rest of it must come from you, listener, dear listeners. Please consider sending a donation or more than one donation. Any amount will do. Don't find yourself making an excuse not to send a donation because it's only a small number of dollars, please, please, you can either go onto our website at freakradio.org, click on donate, and you will find a mechanism to make a PayPal donation. If you don't want to do that, simply send your check, personal check or money order, maybe a cashier's check, if that works, to the following address. You send it to Free Radio Santa Cruz, simply write on the envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, S-A-N-T-A, Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. I'll give it out again. You can also go to our website, click on the donate list link, and you will see our address there as well. It's also under the contact link on our website. The exact address for sending not only your donations, but your comments, questions, and if you are so inclined, if you have an idea for a program, indeed, you might even want to do your own regular program on free radio, on FRSC. The application for doing so, you will find the template there, download and print the application, fill it out, and send it to the same address, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811. Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Thank you so much. Let me give out the phone numbers now. We'll have another musical break. Two lines direct to the studio. And it being now 4.02 p.m. on this Monday, July 27th, if that matches with your personal time-space continuum, you know the program is live and I'm here and I'll pick up the phone. You may call at any time. The area code here in Santa Cruz County, California is 831 for both phone numbers, area 831, line number 1, 427-3772. Again, that's 427-3772. Line number 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119.
اسمع المجلس من نعيم افندي كركنت وهات معطوس
Thank you. اسطوانات نجمة الشرق الأستاذ رضا الله البني.
طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهد الحيل
حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي حلمت النمرة بمنامي السبعة طلعت قدامي صرت أحسب أرقامي صرت أحسب أرقامي وحسابي رح عب الكيل وحسابي رح عب الكيل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان بين لي اني ربحان حطيت مية على حصان واحد.
Don't forget, folks, you can call in area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772.
427-3772.
كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح كان معي مال بحبح ظنت حالي رح اربح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح طلعت من اللعب مشرشح وما تغمض جفني بالليل ما تغمض جفني بالليل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين مرة بتربح شريالين ومرات بتخسر ألفين كل خسارة على الحالين كل خسارة على الحالين حالتنا صفت بالويل وحالتنا صفت بالويل
لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل لعب الخيل لعب الخيل طير عقلي وهب الخيل
You're listening to Lab El Khail. We're playing the horses. Russell Bunai, born around 1904, resides at this riding. It's over a good 20 years ago or so, in the same neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to which he immigrated as a teen from Damascus, Syria. As a young singer and reek player, R-I-Q-Q, it's spelled here, Bunai performed first only informally at house parties or sahras in the community, in the Boston community. Later, by negotiating concerts, planning programs, establishing dress codes, and endorsing, quote, respectable behavior among musicians and patrons, Bunai was instrumental in the evolution of the Hofla, party, the context for musical performance that became institutionalized in Arab American community. In the Arab American community. And I was just on my own cell phone talking to a family member who said the previous, the song just before that was terrible. She couldn't stand it. It was flute imitation, it says here. The announcement, Ismail Mijwiz Minaim Effendi Karaband, or listen to the Mijwiz from Mr. Naim Karaband, indicates that this is not the imitation of a flute, as is written on the record label, but rather of the single reed, double piped clarinet, in quotes, clarinet, of Levantine folk music, the Mijwiz. Recorded in the early 1920s, this is the previous piece of music here before this last one. Karaband's performance reflects the affinity of Arab musicians and audiences for the reedy nasal timbre of this folk instrument. His imitation of the Mijwiz, or of the flute, I guess, is accompanied by a technique heard widely throughout the Levant and in Turkey, Greece, and perhaps even other areas in the Balkans. I'm not reading all the details. You'd have to get your own copy of this Rounder Records album. 1997 is the Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. Rounder Records Corporation is at 1 Camp Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02140. Back to it. Lots of interesting stuff. Why is the New York Times swift boating J Street? You know, I have, for as long as I've been paying attention to the NYT, I've recognized it as a generally quite thorough, depth-reaching news organization that often has a lot more material about a single subject than one might want to read. Or I shouldn't say often. I remember one instance in particular when it had, during the attempted peace processes exercised by Yasser Arafat and the leaders of Israel some 20 years ago, the New York Times, the Times really went into the exact wording of certain documents and the PLO charter and all that. Now, I don't know, the NYT seems to be more and more under Zionist control. Israeli Zionist control. They have a way of swinging that baton around and keeping people in line, even the Times. So this from Robert Namon of MoveOn.org. Why is the New York Times swift boating J Street? Dear X, whoever this may concern, people who want to destroy the nuclear agreement with Iran to pave the way for another war are trying to swift boat supporters of the deal as, quote, anti-Israel. Their latest outrage? Swift boating J Street in the New York Times. J Street is a largely American Zionist or pro-Israel group, which is left-leaning and endeavors to maintain a Zionist state of Israel while at the same time supporting and recognizing the rights of Palestinians to live well on their own land. That's who J Street is. Namon says here, I called out the New York Times in a piece at Huffington Post. I think I'm going to read that piece to you now. Indeed, I am going to read it to you. By Robert Namon, Policy Director for Just Foreign Policy. He often writes for or through MoveOn.org, but he's with Just Foreign Policy. Yesterday, July 26, why is the New York Times Swift Boating J Street. On July 23rd, the New York Times published an op-ed by Shmuel Rosner, political editor at the Jewish Journal and a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute, which made the following claim. Quote, there are American organizations, such as J Street, that supports goals that barely any Israeli agrees with, that nevertheless flaunt the pro-Israel label. End quote. July 23rd, the Times published the op-ed, which included that claim. No explanation was given of what these goals are, nor was any evidence given that, quote, barely any Israeli agrees with these goals. While New York Times editors didn't make Shmuel Rosner specify what the alleged goals of J Street are that barely any Israeli agrees with, context suggests the most obvious explanation. J Street has backed the Obama administration's diplomacy with Iran and is backing the Iran nuclear deal. And that's why opponents of the Iran nuclear deal are attacking J Street and saying that J Street's claim to be pro-Israel is dubious. So let's assume that this is about diplomacy with Iran and the nuclear Iran and the Iran nuclear deal. And in parentheses here, the New York Times should certainly clarify this. You can urge them to do so yourself, says Robert Neiman, the article of this op-ed. And he continues, should the New York Times have allowed Shmuel Rosner to assert without evidence that J Street's backing of the Iran nuclear deal represents barely any Israeli and calls into question whether J Street is pro-Israel? That was a question. Should the New York Times have allowed Rosner to assert without evidence, etc.? And then he provides several links to many examples of senior members of the Israeli national security establishment speaking in support of the Iran nuclear deal. Members of the Israeli national security establishment speaking in support of the deal. Think about their American counterparts and imagine that someone claimed that barely any American held a view that all those people held. Would the New York Times print such a claim? Moreover, polling data indicates that the majority of American Jews back the deal. So let me just insert here. I read a day or two ago that someone says that an overwhelming majority, 9 out of 10, according to what I read, of Americans in general oppose the deal. Here, the author is saying polling data indicates that the majority of American Jews specifically back the Iran nuclear deal. So if Rosner's standard for, quote, pro-Israel is opposition to the Iran nuclear deal, then according to Rosner's standards, the majority of American Jews would not be pro-Israel, which proves that Rosner's standards would be absurd. If someone claimed that the majority of American Jews are not pro-Israel, would the New York Times print that claim? Grabbing some water there. Okay. It is a kind of swift boating to claim that J Street is not pro-Israel because it backs the Iran nuclear deal when senior members of the Israeli national security establishment and the majority of American Jews support the deal. And this swift boating concerns everyone who supports diplomacy with Iran because for many congressional Democrats, J Street supports this, end quote, is a marker for it's relatively safe for congressional Democrats to stand with the Obama administration on this without too much fear of being attacked as anti-Israel. J Street is protecting Democrats who support diplomacy. The opponents of diplomacy are attacking the J Street shield. Whoops. And I'll be right back with you here. This the J Street Shield. Some people cynically dismiss concerns about the New York Times regarding war and peace. What do you expect from the New York Times? Judy Miller, blah, blah, blah. This response, while perhaps seeming radical, is counterproductive to efforts to promote peace. The New York Times has too much power to promote war for people who want less war to ignore it. The New York Times has more power to promote war than most members of Congress. Most members of Congress are pretty jazzed if the New York Times reports something that they say in a single day. The New York Times is shaping debate on war and peace every single day, more than most individual members of Congress are on a very good day. If we want to prevent war in the future, we need to take a, quote, broken windows policing approach to any hint of warmongering at the Times, and that includes any swift boating of advocates for diplomacy. Perhaps you might think, well, it's an opinion piece. That's that guy's opinion. He's entitled to his opinion. But the New York Times claims to fact check its op-eds. Indeed, they fact-check letters to the editor. According to the Times, people are not allowed to say whatever they want in the Times, even in an opinion piece. I think the Santa Cruz Sentinel can learn a lot from that position. Anyway, continuing. I know this intimately from personal experience of submitting letters to the New York Times. I have had the following experience repeatedly. I submit a letter to the Times. The Times expressed interest in printing the letter. They then presented me with an edited version of my letter that was substantially different from the letter that I submitted, claiming that this was necessary to comply with their standards for factual accuracy. When I provided evidence for the factual claims that they were disputing, they said, "This is the letter that we're willing to print, take it or leave it." At that point, I have always capitulated on the theory that it would be better to have the Times print its version of my letter than no letter at all. A sharp example when this occurred is publicly documented. In April 2000, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, by his own later account, was a dogmatic, quote, free trader, someone who supported anything labeled free trade without bothering to examine the actual details. Subsequently, emulating the exemplary John Maynard Keynes, he changed his mind in the light of new evidence. But in April 2000, Krugman attacked me, Robert Namon, by name in his Times column as a representative of people who were then protesting the policies of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. In Krugman's account, my criticism of the World Bank's role in the destruction of Mozambique's cashew nut processing industry was ignorant of economics. Actually, it was someone else's criticism. I had forwarded an article by a Mozambique expert to the people managing the protesters' website. Krugman's argument was, Robert Namon is ignorant. Therefore, all the protesters are ignorant. Therefore, the protesters' concerns can be dismissed. I figured that having been attacked in the New York Times by name, I had the right of response. I asked for an op-ed and was told that the Times doesn't allow op-eds in response to columns, but that I could send a much shorter letter to the editor, which I did. And he gives an example here of both the letter that I sent and the Times written letter that the Times agreed to publish instead. And parenthetically, Namon says, "I experienced some vindication when a Washington Post reporter went to Mozambique to investigate and wrote a piece. A Mozambican official has suggested to me that I try to recruit a reporter to settle the dispute." Harvard development economist Danny Roderick later wrote a piece. And by the way, when I use vague qualifiers like a piece, etc., he has Naaman has all kinds of links, computer links in this. Obviously, I'm on the net here, and I'm not going to, you know, break open every one of these links and lengthen these letter any more than I have to. You can go to the New York Times Internet Edition. Look for the Swift Boating J Street article if you want to look at them yourself. So let's finish the article. I bring this up now not to revisit the fight with Krugman, who, as far as I'm concerned, has reformed his ways and is now an ally beyond measure to the critics of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and the corporate-managed trade agenda, but to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that the New York Times does not take the position that you or I can write whatever we want in an opinion piece at the Times. That the New York Times does not take the position that you or I can write whatever we want in an opinion piece at the Times. Critics of the Iran deal are talking about the President of the United States. And another link like this. Does he really expect people to read an article the way that he provides all these links? Anyway, there is a group of people that they are trying to organize and inflame with claims that Obama is anti-Israel and the Iran nuclear deal is anti-Israel, and people who support the Iran nuclear deal are anti-Israel. The support of J Street for the Iran deal is a big obstacle to this storyline. That's why these people are going after J Street. The big crime of J Street for the Iran nuclear deal opponents is that J Street is defending President Obama. Big crime. They're swift voting J Street as part of their project of swift voting President Obama. And then Naaman closes by saying, you can urge New York Times editors to investigate this unsubstantiated attack on J Street here. I'll probably deal with that later. And for those who keep blinking out when I use the term swift voting, to remind, when John Kerry ran for the president against to prevent W from landing his second presidential term back in 2004, 3 and 4, John Kerry was a Vietnam veteran with the United States Navy, and he was on duty in a swift boat. If you've seen the movie Apocalypse Now, I guess that would be an example or a close example of what was meant by a swift boat, a smaller version of a World War II PT boat, patrol torpedo boat, which monitored and patrolled the Mekong River and probably other inland waterways in Vietnam, or what at the time was South Vietnam. The whole idea of quote-unquote swift boating has to do with the fact that the Republicans, supporters of Republican incumbent presidential candidate George W. Bush, perpetuated and made a super big deal out of the fact that Kerry chased down a Vietnamese child, at least under the age of 18, I forget how old he was, shot him in the back, and there was not even, you know, there was a certain perceived lack of substantiation of the efficacy of that story and other things related to it. And they made such a deal out of this, you know, so-called swift boat John Kerry episode that this Naaman is, he's certainly riding the swift boat angle on that. Folks, you can call in here. It's only 4:32. And call me at, just call me. Never mind about what. I mean, you know, I'm trying to make it. I make a big deal about people calling so that I don't have to drone on and on, and people can poke holes in my accounts, if you will, and make your statement. Area code 831-427-3772. Let's just concentrate on line number one, 427-3772. The lines are open. The ringers are on. If you need to remind yourself of the number, go to our website, freakradio.org, and click the contact link. Arranged in a circle or full semicircle around the central emblem of that webpage. Okay, let us get back to our folder. This is the Mideast Migraine Show at 4:33 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz with your host, Ren Tawil. You know, I've said a few things today and on previous programs about the power of the Israeli lobby in Washington, D.C., and the overall power of Israel, the government of Israel, in conjunction with the support of American Jews in our own government. That really raises the hackles of a lot of people when you talk about the Jews are controlling everything and the Zionists control the world. I'm not saying the Jews control the world, but there's absolutely no question in my mind or the minds of many learned people, many far more learned than me, that there is a great deal of Zionist Jewish influence in anything that has to do with the state of Israel. AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which in reality I see as the American Israel Public Action Committee, AIPAC, AIPAC, is, along with the National Rifle Association, one of the two most powerful and, according to many internal congressional acknowledgments, one of the most intimidating lobbying forces in D.C. If you don't want to take my word for it, take the words of various congressional representatives and senators who will go so far as to admit that. I read a book a year or so ago on my Saturday program called They Dare to Speak Out, which addressed that exact scenario with our own government officials and reps daring to say the truth about the power of Israel in our American Congress. So you can go to radioforall.net and look up episodes going way, way back, about a year, of They Dare to Speak Out. I, instead of spelling it out in every archived recording of the podcast, I would simply say, let me see, They Dare to Speak Out, TD2SO, They Dare to Speak Out, and then I would give slightly further description of that podcast. And or buy the book yourself. It's by former U.S. Congressman from Illinois, Paul Findlay, They Dare to Speak Out. It's probably most likely available in one form or another, and probably for a really good price at Amazon.com. Okay. A new DVD is available covering the recent Washington conference on the Israeli lobby sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. You can view major portions on the DVD below. Ooh, ooh. Don't pass this by. You may want to order your own DVD. PIAC, well, our own local Palestine-Israel Action Committee in Santa Cruz here, might want to hold a public meeting viewing parts of this, if not all of this, major expose. The website, IsraelLobbyUS.org. DVD covering the recent Washington conference on the Israeli lobby, sponsored by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. No, I don't think I'll play it. But there is a promotion for it here. The Israel lobby. Is it good for the U.S.? Is it good for Israel? Washington, D.C., April 10, at the National Press Club. Yeah, I'm sure you can go to the National Press Club's website and look up April 10, the Israel lobby, and play it for yourself. Video of the 2015 conference. YouTube video playlist. Apparently it's available on YouTube. How big is the Israel lobby today? What does the Israel lobby do? Why is there increasing conflict with Israel lobby programs? Just a very quick synopsis of these, of what that DVD is about. Here, it's 4:38, and I think I'd really like to go ahead and play for you that one chapter, that one other chapter that I was stressing from the movie, really mostly filmed snippets of Noam Chomsky speaking. It's called Noam Chomsky, Rebel Without a Pause. Here is what he has to say about mass media and control. Noam Chomsky, mass media and control.
First of all, their pressure on the national media has an effect. I mean, look, even in totalitarian states, they respond to pressure, certainly in more democratic societies. So there are pressures on the media have an effect. Furthermore, the media are in many ways more open and free than they were 40 years ago because they reflect the general raising of the level of civilization. I mean, a lot of people in the media are people who came through the experiences of the 60s and 70s and 80s, and they're just different than they were 40 years ago. So you don't get the kind of, you know, unquestioning loyalty. I mean, if an American president today tried to do what Kennedy did in 1962, there'd be an uproar in the media, not just in the public. And besides, there's now alternatives, like one of the earlier questioners mentioned, that the Internet is a major alternative. New technology, which wasn't developed for that purpose, but it's there, is giving all sorts of options for alternative ways of communicating. For one thing, printing is just a lot cheaper than it ever was. You know, it's desktop publishing is now very feasible. You don't have to have a big printing establishment. The electronic communications there are all kinds of ways. Organizations that develop, you know, they develop their own intercommunication and interaction and media, and that's the way things happen. You know, so there's plenty of opportunities.
I remember the criticisms, you know, that American media were making of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan at the time. And Chomsky turned around and said,
"This is the words of Derek Rasmussen, activist.
Russians in Afghanistan, the audience for them, who's going to hear that, isn't going to be able to do much to help the Afghans. And you can sound very pious about it, but if you're, the real test of protest is who your audience is, and are you addressing an audience that can do something to improve the situation? If you're addressing Americans about what Russians are doing in Afghanistan, that's kind of cowardly," is what he said. Really, American media should be addressing American public and American leaders about what they're doing around the world and supporting the Indonesians in East Timor or supporting death squads in El Salvador. That kind of stuff is courageous. But criticizing Russians, that's for the Russian media to do, and because they can actually have an impact on the Russian public and Russian politicians.
I mean, the period when the press was most free was about the mid-19th century. I mean, at that time, just keeping to say England and the United States, the two cases that have been studied, I imagine it's the same elsewhere. In the mid-19th century, there was a very lively, popular press, very widely read by, you know, working people, by everyone, that, you know, much reached far beyond the commercial media at the time. It was very diverse. It represented, you know, it reflected public interest and public concerns, and it was very popular. In Britain, they tried to close it down by censorship of various kinds, but that didn't work. There were too many ways to avoid it. And it was finally understood that the way to eliminate it was by advertising, by reliance on advertising and by concentration of capital. So just through the effect of reliance on advertising, which was then just a, you know, kind of beginning, like around a century ago, and concentration of capital, they've realized that over time they could marginalize the independent popular press, which couldn't get the advertising, of course, because advertisers don't like what they were saying, didn't have the capital. And it took a long time. So in England, it was actually up until about 40 years ago, still the case 40 years ago, that the main newspaper in England, the Daily Herald, was a kind of labor-oriented social democratic newspaper, very popular. Everybody had outsold all the others. The Mirror, which was the main tabloid, was the same kind of leftist paper, popular paper. But they kind of succumbed to advertising pressure and capital control. The United States happened a bit earlier, but it was the same process. Advertising is. It's part of a much bigger industry. Advertising is part of the public relations industry, which is a huge industry. And it developed very consciously around the First World War in the two most democratic countries, England and the United States. And there's a good reason for it. They were coming to as the countries were becoming more free, that just through popular struggle and people were winning the franchise and you couldn't shut them up anymore by force, it was understood that you're going to have to control people by controlling opinion and attitudes because we can't rely on force anymore. And control of opinion and attitudes means, there was actually a phrase for it. This was the time when what was called scientific management of work was becoming a big issue, Taylorite management, Ford and all that stuff. It was also understood you want to not only control very closely the lives of people in their work time, but also you have to control them in their off-work time. And what you have to do is turn them into passive, obedient consumers don't try to get out of our hair, basically. Pay attention to what were called the superficial things of life, like fashionable consumption. You get them trapped into consumerism, isolated from one another, atomized, control their beliefs. That's where notions like manufacture of consent come from right after this First World War. And out of this came huge industries. And advertising is a large part of it, and it, of course, affects the media enormously. I mean, if any of you are, if you watch television, for example, take television. When you turn on the television set, the corporation doesn't make any money, right? Like you don't pay them when you turn it on, unless it's cable. But they do. So why do they do it? Well, they do it because of the advertising. So resources and the creativity and the effort and so on in the whole television industry goes into advertising. In fact, within the television industry, there are words called content and fill. Like a program has content and a program has fill. The content is the advertising. The fill is the car chase that's in there to keep you watching until the next ad comes along. And all the effort, of course, goes into the advertising. And the fill has first of all, it's keep your interest enough so you watch the advertising, but the advertising is there for a purpose. I mean, it's to turn people into creatures whose only concern in life is to max out their 5 credit cards not to pay attention to what's going on in the world and let the rich, powerful guys do what they want without interference. So I'm on mainstream television all the time. In Ireland, England, Italy, New Zealand. I mean, there's television. In fact, the public television studios in Boston, all the staff knows me very well. I'm there all the time for satellite broadcasts to even used to be Canada, too. That's now declined. And occasionally in the United States, I mean, commercial television.
Whoops. Forgive me. I interrupted his talk there. I wish I could figure out exactly where I left him off. Just just experimenting with my newfound CyberLink Power DVD feature, which allows me to view certain videos without having to resort to going to YouTube to view them on this computer. It works fine and dandy, but I'm still exploring. It's wonderful. I got all kinds of wonderful audio pieces from other DVDs that I've been wanting to be able to utilize on this program. While we're waiting to catch up to where Professor Chomsky was talking about, let me remind you that I'll be back next Monday at 3 p.m., as I am every week in one form or another, for the usual Monday edition of Mideast Migraines. 1500 hours, 3 p.m. every Monday. And, of course, I'm reading the closing chapters, now the closing chapters of Christopher Lee Bolin's remarkable book entitled Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. It certainly, 9/11 certainly did change our world. Turned our lives upside down and several times over turned the lives of Afghanis, Iraqis, various other peoples in the Middle East and elsewhere upside down. Millions of Muslim lives have been lost, largely, mostly due to being at the brunt of bombs dropped by the United States, Britain, and the so-called coalition partners. That's the book that I'm still reading on the Saturday edition, 11 a.m. Pacific time. Every Saturday, 11 a.m., I'll finish this book, and then you'll be hearing more about a local in Santa Cruz County here, revitalized 9/11 truther movement. So I'm using Christopher Bolin's book as a launching pad for that. Let's get back to Chomsky here.
But I did read it, and the first reading took 2 minutes and 36 seconds. So they told me, no, I've got to reread it. So I read it a little faster, got it into 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and then...
Just backing things up here a little bit. Whoops again.
I'm pretty well known around Boston, you know, and that happens to be the center, the ideological center for National Public Radio. It's their flagship station and all that sort of thing. There's a lot of pressure there to let me be on now and then. So during the first Gulf War, they did approach me, and they told me I would be allowed to have 2.5 minutes. They insisted that I write out what I was going to say, send it to the central office so they could ensure that it's, you know, okay. And once they approved it, I had to read it. And they pre-recorded it to make sure that I wouldn't add a phrase that wasn't, that went off the limit. The first time, I thought it's kind of ridiculous, but then so did the staff. The staff's mostly laughing, the engineers and so on. But I did read it, and the first reading took 2 minutes and 36 seconds. So they told me, no, I've got to reread it. So I read it a little faster, got it into 2 minutes and 30 seconds, and then they actually did run it. And there are other things like that. I'll just mention one other case. Same National Public Radio again, the kind of left medium. They have a book review thing. And again, they're under a lot of pressure often to have something about books of mine. Around 10 years ago, there was a book of mine that was based on lectures over CBC. And it was actually a bestseller in Canada for years, but you know, nobody ever heard of it in the United States. It was never reviewed or anything. But there was pressure around Boston to get them to review that book. Okay, so they finally agreed. And we again had a pre-recorded 5-minute interview with Robert Siegel, who's their big shot intellectual, and it was actually announced their main program, it's called All Things Considered, starts at 5 o'clock, and then, you know, every educated person is supposed to listen to it. And at 5 o'clock, they announced that they were going to have a review of this book. The publishers, South End Press, called me up and said, "Ah, great, it's going to be on." It got to 5:30. It got to 5:25. At 5:25, the program stopped, and there were 5 minutes of music. You know, at 5:30, when they move into the next segment, they announced the next segment, and phone calls started coming in from all over the place, saying, "You know, what happened to that five-minute review?" And people, I wasn't listening, but people started calling me and saying, "You know, what happened to the review?" So after about 10 minutes, I got a call from the manager of the whole thing in Washington, who said, "You know, something very strange. We're getting a lot of calls saying that your review didn't appear, but we know that it did. I see it right on my program here." So I said, "You know, I don't know. Don't know anything about it." About 10 minutes later, she called me back, very chagrined. And she said that she was overruled for the first time ever by some higher-up who heard the announcement in the first 5 minutes and canceled it. Well, you know, that caused quite a furor. She was very upset, you know, for a professional reason, didn't want to be overruled. And there was a lot of public reaction. So they finally agreed to redo another 5 minutes, you know, pre-recorded, and that one, the second one they actually ran. Well, that's off at the left liberal end of the spectrum. When you move to the more conservative commercial media, they're less constrained.
There are some extremely violent right-wing groups that, for whom he is absolute anathema. I mean, they're virtually the devil incarnate. And these are groups that in the past have not hesitated to use violence or even assassination to make their case. Most of the strongest hostility at the moment seems to be coming from Zionist groups, as far as we could observe. There was a Cambodian group that put up posters denouncing him for what they claimed was denying that there was ever a massacre in Cambodia in the 1970s, which in fact he never has done, though he's disputed details of the official story that came out at that time.
Okay, let's stop it there. We're getting into some extraneous territory. Remarkable, isn't it, to hear about how, in Professor Noam Chomsky's opinion, National Public Radio is the most restrictive, or at least the most heavily edited, approximately, as the professor put it, of all the various news services in the United States. And I kind of chuckled to myself when he somewhat cynically said during his talk, you know, that's the emphasis is put on National Public Radio, and we're all supposed to listen to NPR. They put All Things Considered on, which I've been a great fan of for about 40, 45 years, almost as long as it's run. But as Chomsky puts it, and we're all supposed to listen to that. Ha ha. Yeah, remarkable. Again, this is from the 2003, I believe. Yes, the 2003 release, Noam Chomsky, Rebel Without a Pause. It's available on Netflix. Now I have to return that to Netflix. I'll bet you it's also on YouTube. It's 12 years old now, and I'll bet you can just go to YouTube and see Rebel Without a Pause. Okay, end of show. Tune in next Monday at 3 p.m. for the next episode of the weekday edition of this program. Mideast Migraines is also continuing with the Christopher Bolin book on Saturday at 11 a.m. Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And don't forget to donate to Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's you and me against the world, folks. Pretty much. I think that says it all. Thank you and ta-ta.